I wonder, as you look out on the world, what you think. Okay, deep down, what do you think? If you look out on the international kind of thing, it's all a bit disappointing and distressing and depressing, I suppose, there. And you might be tempted to turn the news off from time to time. But you see rulers, don't you? A particular ruler at this moment. But you see, if you look away from the Ukraine, you see lots of other places in the world where there are rulers invading and destroying other people's lives. And the powerful crushing the weak. And you know, I was thinking about this and looking back over history. I've got a son-in-law who's a historian, and the pastor, I think, is a bit of a historian. And, you know, if you look back at history, this is just a repeat of what's gone on before. Rulers have come in with their doctrine and their beliefs and their mantras, and for a cause that's right in their own head, they invade and kill and destroy. And yet within a few decades, if less, they're gone, they're forgotten, their doctrines are replaced by a new set, and history repeats itself. What if you kind of consider these things? You get caught up in the moment, but if you step back, just a repeat of what's happened throughout the whole of history. But then maybe you look more locally, and I was looking down at the street the other day, there was a skip outside a house. And I think the people that had lived there for many years had probably moved into a nursing home or died. And there was a skip. And in the skip was a kind of looked like a brand new kitchen. But of course, the new people had moved in, didn't like the colour. And that pride and joy that those people had scrimped and saved for, probably took out a loan for, and has just thrown the skip, and a new kitchen's gone in. You think, what a waste. What a waste. I was tempted to go and get it out. It looks so good. Okay, what a waste. You know, so life just goes round and it just seems, I don't know, perplexing at times. Yesterday I had to take my car down for a sort of service related thing. And I was standing in the showroom waiting for the people in front of me. And there was a little girl, she was 9 months old, being held by her mother. And she was the cutest little girl, sort of pink. And she, you know, some children just stare at grown ups. But this one smiled, you know, and I smiled back. And I thought, what a lovely little girl. And I thought, well, she's got a whole life in front of her. And then a few hours later, we were walking down into the town to get the coffee, meet the family. And there was an old lady struggling back, bowed over with care, with her shopping bags, struggling to make it home. Her life was almost over. And I thought, that little girl and that old lady was that little girl. It's a short movie. Life is over quite quickly. And it goes round, and it just repeats over and over again. And if you were, I'm not sure we talk about aliens, but if you were kind of an alien coming in to planet Earth, and you were sort of observing, you'd kind of wonder, you'd say, well, is there a bit of a waste of time? All that effort, all that turmoil, all that emotion that we go through in our lives, what a waste of time, because we all die in the end. You say, this, I came to be cheered up this morning, Mike. I really came to church so I want to be cheered up. Well, hang on in there, as the preacher does a remarkable thing, the preacher of the sermons we're going to look at. But maybe you say, well, yes, but I'm a Christian. I know there's a meaning to life, so you don't have to sort of push that one too far. Okay, well, what about your Christian life? Here you are, you've given your life to Christ, or he's taken your life, I suppose, and you live for him, and you tithe, you give some of your money to the Lord's work. You sacrifice your time, you work hard in the church, and you seem to get little reward for it, but you battle on. Bit of a thankless job in a way, if you look at it on the surface. Those nice people who live next door, those people you work with, they seem lovely people. They don't have all those cares. They prosper, they're happy, they get through life just the same, in fact, probably better than you do. You go, are you ever tempted to think to yourself, well, maybe I'll just sort of take my foot off the accelerator a bit and just kind of relax and, you know, just have a sort of nominal Sunday Christianity, because it's all too much like hard work. So the question this morning is a very simple question, and this is the question that the writer of Ecclesiastes, this is a collection of sermons. It's a collection of sermons. Is it all worth it? In fact, he goes deeper than that, and he says, is life worthwhile? It's just a meaningless sort of cycle. Andy read to us that passage from chapter 1. And, you know, that he uses the analogy of the sun going up and the sun coming down, the wind going round and the rain falling into the rivers and the rivers evaporating into the... And it just goes on. And he says, just like that. It's just sort of repetitive, it's meaningless, it has no purpose. So the question this morning is, life under the sun, which is the term he uses for life here on this earth, is life under the sun meaningless? Well, we have a preacher, and we're going to invite him to tell us. His name is King Solomon, and I want you to imagine he's the visiting speaker this morning, because he is the visiting speaker, because that's what the Bible is, isn't it? The Bible is God's word to us. And King Solomon comes through over time, a sort of time transport machine, as it were, and he comes to us this morning, and he's going to tell us his verdict. Now, before we listen to what he's got to say, we probably, because it's quite radical, now we've heard that this preacher was a radical preacher. He stands in the pulpit and his aim is to shock. And maybe at Copse Road we're not kind of used to shocking preachers. So we might want to get the deacons to check him out before we invite him. So we get his CV out, ask some people, what's he like, this guy? Is he safe to have? Is he going to frighten visitors away? So we need to check him out. So I've only got 3 points. We haven't got any projection, but my 3 points are very, very simple. They've got P's in them, so you should remember them quite easily. Okay. But the first one is the preacher. Who is the preacher? And if you've got your Bible, by the way, please do find Ecclesiastes. Hard book to find, but find Ecclesiastes, because we will be dipping into it. So it's really encouraging when the preacher says, oh, have a look at this, and nobody looks. So if you could do, because it's God's word. So make sure this preacher is on the right lines, and put your hand up if he's not and tell him so, because we need to make sure. So the words of the preacher, the son of David, this is chapter 1, verse 1. We're going to be mainly looking at chapter 1, but it's a kind of a way of introduction to the book as well. So we're going to be reaching into other chapters. So we're going to dart around a little bit. So in chapter 1, verse 1, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. He doesn't name himself as Solomon, but he clearly is King Solomon. Okay, and we've all heard of King Solomon. Okay. Now, what do we know about him? Well, if we go, and you don't need to turn this up, but if you go back to 1 Kings chapter 3, we are told a remarkable incident in his life. King David, great king of Israel, has died, and Solomon, his son, is now king. And the Lord appeared to Solomon, we read, in a dream by night, and God said to him, ask what I shall give you. That's interesting, isn't it? Do you know, I was thinking about that. I thought, actually, I might just preach the sermon on that. You imagine that God came to you at night in a dream, but real, you knew this was real, and God said to you, what do you want? What do you want? Well, actually, Jesus does say that, doesn't he? He says, ask of me, and it shall be given to you. So, interesting, isn't it? What do we ask God for? But anyway, God said to him, what do you want? And Solomon said, basically, he said, this job you give me, it's too hard. I'm like a child. He wasn't a child, but he was a novice. He said, I don't know how to rule these people. These are your people, Lord. It's quite an important job. And he said this, give your servant an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to govern this, your great people? And then we read this, it pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked for this. And God said to him, behold, I give you a wise and discerning mind, so that none like you has been before you, and none like you shall arise after you. I give you also what you have not asked, both riches and honour, so that no other king shall compare with you all your days. Excuse me a minute. I realise there was something missing. And I can see it, but just about. Okay, so here's a man who has been given wisdom, and we are told that none like him before and none like him after has been that wise. So he is the wisest man apart from Christ who has ever walked the planet, including anyone today and anyone coming in the future. So here's the preacher that we've heard. He's coming. He's a bit of a shocking preacher. He's a provocative preacher. But we've heard that he's the wisest man in the universe. I think we'd invite him. Definitely invite him. Okay? But, and there's generally a but in the Bible, generally a but when it comes to its hearers. And this is the thing about this book, by the way. This is a remarkable book because, you know, most books you read about, it extols its heroes. But the Bible is very honest about its heroes. And it tells us something that perhaps we'd rather not know, but it tells us anyway. In chapter 11 of 1 Kings, we read this. Now, King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, "You shall not enter into marriage with them." For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, small g, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. So here's a man that we've invited into the pulpit, and he's got experience of life living both sides of the railway line. He's lived over here, where he's fallen into great sin. 700 wives and concubines. And I mean, it's astonishing the sin he fell into. And then over here is a man who was the wisest man who's ever lived, who knew blessings from God beyond anything that anybody had known before or since. So here's a man that we invite into our pulpit. We could say he's the real deal. We could say he's got the T-shirt, he's been there, done it. But he's now going to step up into the pulpit and tell us what he knows. And we're all ears, for sure. Might be a bit worried what he's going to say. So the key to understanding the book of Ecclesiastes, if you've ever tried to read it, it's a really tough book. It's one of the wisdom books in the Bible. It's a really tough book because... It's just a really tough book to read. It's just hard to work out what's going on. But the key to understanding it is that the writer looks at life from two perspectives. That's the key to understanding the book. He stands over here. I've got a bit of paper, actually. We didn't have any projections, so I got my 2 points on thing. So my first point, I'll give you both my points, is this. Position number one, I've just called it number one, life without God in the picture. So we'll put that one down there. And the second position is life with God in the picture. We can stick that up on there. Okay. And so what he does, he moves between these two positions through the book. And it's not always clear on a first reading where he's standing, and sometimes he mixes it up, and it's written in a poetic style from the Far East, so it's not the kind of writing that we're used to. It's not the sort of Daily Mail or the Telegraph or the Times or the Express or whatever. It's not written like that, so you've got to spend time studying this book. But he takes these two positions, and we're just going to take those as our 2 points. So our first point then is life through the perspective of someone who has left God out of their view. God is missing. So you notice what he says in verse 2. He says, "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher. "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity." He uses the word vanity 5 times in one verse. Now, if you think of the word vanity, Andrew helpfully explained another word to us there. What was it? Vexation, wasn't it? Yeah. The word vanity, well, you might think vanity is somebody who spends who loves themselves a bit too much. Would that be a good description of vanity? Too long in front of the mirror. You know, oh, look at me, I'm just wonderful, yeah? But that's not what it means here. The use of that word has changed over the years. Lots of English words have changed their meaning. And there's lots of those in the Bible. So you've got to be careful reading some of the words, because sometimes they're using an old kind of use of the word. So if we take what the word actually means literally, it means mist or smoke. That's what vanity means. If you read some of the more modern versions, it says futility or meaningless. But actually the word means mist or smoke. And as I was studying the book of Ecclesiastes, I was trying to think to myself, is there anything in the New Testament that references Ecclesiastes? Because, you know, usually sometimes, like Isaiah, for example, you can make these connections. And I was struggling with this, and I thought, oh, actually, I think James makes reference a couple of times. James was one of those books that Luther thought shouldn't be in the New Testament. He actually thought it was, but it's a wisdom book. But it does make sense, of course, when you look at it through the eyes of somebody who trusts Christ. And James says this. He says, what is your life? For you are a mist, a vapor. The same thing. That appears for a little time, then vanishes. That's James chapter 4, verse 14. And so this word vanity, this word is mist. It's a metaphor. It's a picture of emptiness, of meaningless. So we could say meaningless, meaningless, vanity, vanity, you know, futility. Everything is meaningless. This is the preacher's opening, you know, your introduction to a sermon. You know, you imagine a preacher standing in the pulpit saying, well, it's all a waste of time, really, if I'm honest. You think, what sort of church is this I've come to? I thought I'd try Copse Road out. It's hopeless. The preacher's just telling us it's all a waste of time. And he does it, you see, because he's trying to shock us. He's trying to shock us. And he's standing over here. Was it position one? Life without God. That's what he's doing. So, let's have a look at this. Now, this preacher has not come to this conclusion lightly. Because in verse 14, he says, he summarizes what he said before. And he says, I reflected on everything that is accomplished by man on earth. And I concluded, everything he has accomplished is futile. And notice what he says, like chasing the wind. I'm using some different paraphrases of these verses as well here. Can you imagine, on this lovely sunny weather, you've got the window open, you look out, and you overlook your neighbour. And there's your neighbour and the family, and they're running around the garden like this. And you kind of think they're probably doing some strange exercise. And you shout out to them, what are you doing? They said, we're chasing the wind. Okay, yeah, definitely. You're going to worry about it. And you're going to say to them, you can't. You'll never catch it. It's waste of time, energy. You just don't come and have a cup of tea. No, we're chasing the wind. And you see, that's what he says life is like. Under the sun, when God is missing from the picture. When God is missing from the picture. Now, someone, if you're in a church now where the congregation are quite interactive, somebody, I think Mike there maybe, or Linda's going to put their hand up and say, hang on, preacher, that's not true. What about all good, honest, hard work? You know, I like my job. I like the things. I like gardening or whatever you do. Good, honest, hard work. Well, the preacher kind of knocks these down like skittles. One by one, he just demolishes these arguments. Look what he says in verse 3, paraphrasing here. What's there to show for a lifetime of work? A lifetime of working your fingers to the bone. That's from a paraphrase called The Message. Not one we'd perhaps use as an accurate translation, but sometimes it brings out some real kind of meaning. You know, what's there to show for a lifetime of work? Working your fingers to the bone. You know, all that schoolwork you did, all those GCSEs and A-levels, all that study, all that degree, that college work you did, all that training, all that overtime, you know, all that worry at work, all that stress. Solomon says, you wasted your time. Why? Because it all evaporates like the mist. In fact, you die at the end. And whether you did all that work or not, if you did all that worry or not, built all that empire of possessions or not, you still end up just like the animals. You're dead and buried. Meaningless. So I told you this preacher aims to shock or depress us to start with. He says it's just like nature. Well, someone says, well, okay, all right, I'll have to come up with a new argument. Well, what about the difference? What about making a difference in life? Surely all the progress man has made in this world. It's wonderful what man has done. Well, look what he says in verse 10. He knocks this one down pretty quickly as well. He says, does someone call out? And again, I've got a paraphrase version here. But verse 10, does someone call out? Hey, this is new. Look at what I've got. Don't get excited. It's the same old story. Nobody remembers what happened yesterday. And all the things that will happen tomorrow, nobody remember them either. Don't count on being remembered. Wow. Do you know, I come from Porter's Head, so I've travelled a long way, haven't I, in my life, okay? But in Porter's Head Parish Churchyard, there's a grave. It's quite close to the gate on one of the roads you come in on. And it's Sir Henry Seagrave. Oh, you never heard of Sir Henry Seagrave? I'm looking around. Yes, you have. Go on then. Oh, do you know what he did? Ah, okay, but you heard of him. Right, so Henry Seagrave, he was a unique man. He held the land speed and the sea speed record simultaneously, the only man to ever done that. And he was the first man to ever go over 200 miles an hour. So what? I mean, I could go and buy a second-hand Lamborghini. Well, I couldn't because I couldn't afford it. But if I could, that would do that. I'm sure there's some tractors, supercharged tractors that get close to that. Okay. So who remembers Sir Henry Seagrave? All that effort he put in. All those engineers working on that car. It's just a grave now, isn't it? It's all forgotten. It's all this progress. You say, well, what about medicine, the internet, all the technology? Yeah, yeah, sure, that's progress. But mankind has not invented anything and come up with anything that actually made a difference to our lives in terms of our purpose. We still strive after the wind. We still have people, you go out on the street and say, what's the meaning of life? People say, we don't know. You say, well, thousands and thousands of years of progress, and we still don't know. We can put a man on the moon. We can put a robot down someone's vein to mend something in their body. And you go, that's astonishing. They go, but what's the meaning of life? They go, well, we don't know. You see, no one's come up with anything new. It's all meaningless from this position. From this position. One generation goes its way, the next one arrives, he says, nothing changes, and in a paraphrase it says, it's business as usual for old planet Earth. I like that. So the question is it all worthless? And the answer is yes. Without God in the picture, it is all worthless. But now, in this sermon, the preacher kind of detects, I suspect, people are thinking about leaving at this point, okay? So he now steps over here. And he says, but if we put the picture right, okay, if we put God in the picture, if we look at life through the eyes of somebody who sees a God, a personal sovereign God, then suddenly everything makes sense. Everything makes sense. So the second point is literally position two, a life with God in the picture. So what does he see? Well, what do we say about work? We say, well, work, all that work, waste of time, wasn't it? Complete waste of time. But now, he says, ah, but it takes on a new meaning. If you go to chapter two, and I told you we'd have to stretch around a little bit, because it's not neatly packaged up, this sermon, like we'd like it to be. In chapter two, verse 24, he addresses the question he's raised in chapter one. Of course, it didn't have chapters, of course, in his sermon. So it's one sermon, actually, chapter one, chapter two, and also just up to the end of chapter two, I think it's one sermon or one collection, I think it is. And it says in verse 24, there's nothing better for a person than he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil, or his labour. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? And James, of course, referencing James again, reminds us every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. Suddenly, he says, life, and in particular here, work, and all the effort we put into life under the sun, suddenly makes sense. Suddenly makes sense. Even the menial things. In fact, he almost says, you know, life, mundane life, regular life, not climbing mountains and having those great experiences, but that ordinary life of washing the dishes, taking the kids to school, looking after the grandchildren, you know, sorting out your investments and cooking the dinner and cleaning and changing the beds. All of that, he says, suddenly takes on meaning when God is in your life and in the picture. You know, to understand this, you almost have to go back and think about who man is. When we say man, we mean mankind, of course. Who man is? What man is? Man was made in the image of God. And God is a working God. 6 days, God created. And there was great joy in his creation. In the work that God did to make the world, there was great joy, because on the seventh day he sat down and he enjoyed it. He said it was very good. God was pleased with what he'd done. God enjoyed Adam and Eve. He fellowshiped with them in the garden. And he gave Adam work to do. Tend the garden, look after the garden. So you see, we are made in the image of God. So we were meant to work. And in heaven, in the new heavens and new earth, we won't be lying on couches being fed grapes by the angels. It won't be a kind of everlasting kind of, you know, sitting around. There'll be work to do. New heavens and the new earth. We don't know the nature of that really, do we? But it will be wonderful. So man is meant to enjoy work. And we see that God has given this to man. I mean, we enjoy the gifts from God. You know, everything we work for is a gift from God. And so the Christian, the person who stands over here, says, you know, I go to work and I get money, or I saved up my life, I draw my pension, whatever it might be, and I get all these things from the supermarket. But you know, these are gifts from God. And suddenly, the Christian says, you know, everything I have is a personal gift from a personal God who loves me. So everything you have, whether you have much or little, it's a gift. But this idea of actually the work itself, that the process rather than the end result, is also something that we should enjoy. What did he say? There's nothing better for a person than he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. Now, I know someone at this point, probably, going to put their hand up, at least they're thinking about it, and saying, hang on a minute, you have no idea what my job's like. Andy might be saying this secretly, yeah? I thought you might be. And Pete's saying, do you know how hard it is on the farm? Freezing cold on a December morning, and I've got to go out and sort the cows out. Or somebody's let their dog in and the sheep have gone mad. And well, not your sheep, but if you had sheep. Okay. And the tractor's broken down and you have no idea. You can't enjoy work. And my boss, if you had my boss, well, you'd know all about work. It's terrible. Okay. Paul writes to the Colossians in chapter 3. And of course you need the New Testament to interpret the Old. And Paul writes something that I'd never really kind of taken in before. I've read it before, but I'd never taken it in. He said this, slaves, obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but with a sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance of your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ. Just think about that for a moment. Slaves. We're not talking here of people who go have a contract and they go to work and they get paid and they get holiday and sick and there's sort of human rights and employment law. These are slaves. These were people bought from the marketplace. These are people who have no wages, no holiday. They're at the beck and call. They get a good lashing if they stepped out of line. They have a cruel master. And yet they've been converted. They've seen Christ. They've understood that Christ went to the cross for them. They've put their faith and trust in Christ. And they've become new people. But they're still slaves. And Paul doesn't say we need to get you free. Okay. He says, obey your masters. When you work, those jobs that you dislike doing for those petulant, cruel masters, do it with enjoyment. Because you're doing it for Christ. So, I was going to ask a question here. I'll put a question down here. When do you worship God? And you might say, well, I'll do it on the Sunday. What about peeling the potatoes? You worship God peeling the potatoes? As well as preparing a sermon? You know, weeding the garden? I don't know, doing something you don't like doing? I don't like weeding the garden. It's probably my worst job. It's probably worse jobs than that. But, you know, can we do it to the Lord? It's a takeaway, isn't it? Takeaway from the morning service. You know, I'm going to go back and everything I do now, I'm going to do it as though I'm actually doing it for the Lord. You say, well, that's too hard. I can't do that. It's all right. It's not ideal, isn't it? Okay, let me just give you one example. Let me give an example. The God of heaven stepped down. As it were, hung up his visible divinity. He didn't ever relinquish his divinity. But he appeared, came as a real man, took on flesh. And he knelt down and he washed the disciples' feet. He got up and he went to the cross. What did he say he was doing? He was doing the work that his Father had given him for the joy that was set before him. That's astonishing, isn't it? The King of Kings, the one we were singing about earlier on, he went to the cross for the joy that was set before him to do the work of his Father. What was the work of his Father? It was to be nailed to a cross and to be punished for the sins of his people. That a transaction may take place. He took on their sins and was punished. And in return, when they put their faith and trust in him personally, he puts his clean robes of righteousness that will stand the test of time and eternity on them. So that's an example. When you're doing a job you hate and you're moaning about it, you know, say, I'm going to do this job for the Lord. And what did it say? Knowing that from the Lord you'll receive an inheritance as your reward. That's astonishing. Those jobs we do to the Lord will receive a reward. God is pleased when we do it to him. We probably won't finish everything I wanted to say here, but do you remember also that he saw life like the seasons? It was endless, it was meaningless, it had no purpose, it was just over and over again, like a clockwork toy going on. And he despaired from over here, it was just an endless thing. But now he steps over here, he suddenly sees something quite different. If you turn to chapter 3, and it's probably the most well-known passage, someone said Ecclesiastes, they say, oh, I never heard of it. But if you read out chapter 3, the first part of chapter 3, everyone's heard of that because I think there was a song, a pop song in the 60s. You know, for every season, turn, that was a song, I think. Okay, so we know that. And as he looks over there, he sees that it all makes sense when God is in the picture. For everything, there is a season and a time for every matter under the heaven. Suddenly, now, he says, life is not random. It's not just this ongoing, everlasting, meaningless process. God is in charge. There is a God in heaven. From this perspective, there is a God in heaven who has a perfect plan. Every detail has been planned by God. And he says, I may not understand the plan. God doesn't give us perfect understanding, but I bow to the one who has the plan. I used to work with some guys who used to be in the military, and there was one particular guy I remember, and he was a commander of a troop of people, and he was telling me that they were out in a war zone. He wouldn't tell me where it was, because I don't think it was publicly known that the British Army were ever there. But he was in this particular place, and he said we had to make our way to another place, and we had to go either through this ravine, or we had to go across open ground, and I didn't know which way to go. And the troops, his men, were there saying, sir, which way are we going? And he said there was no way of knowing. He had no intelligence where the enemy were. So he said, I went for a walk. He wasn't a Christian, this man. He said, I went for a walk on the block. He said, I came back and said, right, we're going this way. He said, because no decision is not a good thing. And he said, and his men just said, okay, sir. And they followed him. Now, fortunately, they got through. There was no enemy. In a way, that's how we're to be, except that God does know the way. God does know the enemy. And we are to say to God, Lord, I believe you have a plan for everything in my life. And I may be going through a tough time now, but you've got the plan. And you're capable of enacting the plan, carrying it out. And I, like a trusting soldier or like a small child with a parent, I trust you. I trust you. And Solomon says, from over here, it all makes sense, even if I don't understand what's going on. It makes sense because God is in control and I am his child and he will get me to pastures new. So we've seen from position one, nothing makes sense. And remember this, when you go out into the world, the majority of human beings on this planet are standing here. The world does not make sense. The philosophers, the great minds, Stephen Hawking's, Dawkins, all those great thinkers with great minds, they are completely in the dark. Nothing makes sense. And if nothing makes sense, eat, drink, and be merry, and live it up. Have a party. But actually, if you carry on reading Ecclesiastes, he says, yeah, I do. I went to the biggest parties in the world. And be quite honest, after a while, they just numb you. That, even that doesn't work, Solomon says. But when you come over here, you see everything makes sense. Now, the question is, maybe you're a bit over here. Maybe someone here, you're over here, you're a bit over there, but you're mostly over here. You don't think life makes sense. You're not really sure about God and Christ and where you stand. So the question is, how did Solomon get from here to here? And we go back to the very beginning of that in what we read in Kings. What was it? The Lord said to him, what do you want? And Solomon said, open my eyes. Show me, Lord, who you are. Give me wisdom. And do you know, that is how I'm going to end this morning. You know, maybe you're unsure about life, death, what's beyond death. Maybe you're unsure about where you're going after death. These are the big questions. If we shy away from these questions, then we're just fooling ourselves. You know, what's the term? We're fiddling while Rome burns, as it were. We're heading towards the end of our lives. And are you going to take Solomon's view and say, well, take a chance, it's all meaningless, we fizzle out like animals, that's what he says? Or do I think that God has put eternity in my heart for a reason? He says that later on. And if you think, yeah, but I'm not sure, then you take action. You say, what action can I take? Solomon, he searched everywhere, he couldn't find the answer. Yes, but he went to God and asked. And he said, Lord, open my eyes, open my heart. And the Bible says, if you seek me, God says, if you seek me with your whole heart, you will find me. God is, you know, like you play hide and seek with the kids, and the very small children, you hide, but after a while you think, they're never going to find me. So you reveal yourself. And God says, I won't hide in too hard a place for you, but I want to see if you're serious. You come and search for me, and you will find me. And what do you find? You find a Saviour who has arms open, wide to welcome you in. Solomon, his life, we don't know how his life ended, but we have his sermon here this morning. Don't be over there. Make sure you're over this side. You've got God in the picture and Christ in your life.